Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Hey, everybody. We recorded this before the news that the Dune sequel had been greenlit came out. So any references that you hear in this to, I wonder if we get a Dune sequel. Just ignore that. We're getting a Dune sequel. Thanks. Bye. I must not fear spoilers. Spoilers are the mind killer. Spoilers are the little death that bring total liberation. I will face my fear. Hey, here's a warning. There's going to be spoilers in this for Dune. There's going to be spoilers in this for the Dune movie, for the Dune books. There's going to be spoilers from the Dune books that can potentially spoil sequels to the Dune movie. So, you know what it is. If you don't want to get spoiled, please check out now. Hello, my name is Jason Concepcion. Sorry to cool voice. Welcome to episode 9 of X-Ray Vision, the Crooked Podcast, where we dive deep into your favorite shows, movies, comics, and pop culture. Today on Previously On, we're just going to be going straight into Dune. I'll be recapping it and talking about some of the box office numbers. Then in a very special airlock, I'll be joined by the wonderful hosts of the Dune podcast, Jason Goldman and H. And then in the omnibus, we'll be talking about the origins of space empires and the relationship between Dune and the iconic sci-fi series that started the whole space empire thing, Isaac Asimov's Foundation. And then in the endgame, we will be joined by the wonderful Shea Serrano to talk about his new book, Hip Hop and Other Things, and to resuscitate our classic cafeteria table segment from the Connect podcast. Can't wait. First, let's recap Dune.
Our planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air.
What's to become of our world?
This is the one I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for this since I read Dune for the first time in high school. At the time, I was reading mostly comic books and Stephen King. And then I read Ender's Game, and I was like, oh my God, I love sci-fi. I want more sci-fi. What's up with sci-fi? And the very first thing someone recommended to me was Dune. And I read Dune, and I absolutely loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. I've read it so many times since. And super, super excited for the release of Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Dune, this coming on the heels of, you know, the rather notable David Lynch version, which is super weird, has its charms. I like it, but it also kind of doesn't super work as a movie. And they made a lot of like really, really big changes to the story that I didn't love. So let's talk about Denis Villeneuve's very loyal adaptation of Dune. We open on a dream, Paul's visions from deep space. We hear the voice of Chaney, who will be Paul's love interest. And we hear her describing her love of her planet, Arrakis. My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Arrakis is the lone source of the spice melange in the galaxy. And that is the most valuable, most important substance in the galaxy. We see a Harkonnen spice harvester bringing in spice, guarded by Harkonnen troops. We see a raiding party of Fremen, the indigenous people of Arrakis, led by Chaney. We see them strike, and the Harkonnen counterattack sends them fleeing back into the desert rocks. At Arrakeen, the colonial capital, we see Glossu, the beast Raban, played by David Bautista, the scion of House Harkonnen, at least at this point, as he oversees the Harkonnen occupation forces. And then later we see the Harkonnens leaving Arrakis on the order of the Padishah Emperor of the galaxy, Shaddam IV. We go to Caladan, home of House Atreides. The year is 10191 AG after the Spacing Guild. So that means after the formation of the Spacing Guild, the group that is solely responsible for ferrying human beings, other, you know, great houses, other traders and such, back and forth across the galaxy. They alone are capable of folding space. And so the foundation of the Spacing Guild is like 10,000 years into our future. So this story is taking place roughly 20,000 years in the future. We meet young Paul Atreides. He is the son of Duke Leto Atreides and his consort, Bene Gesserit's sister, Lady Jessica, who is Paul's mother. We meet them at breakfast. Lady Jessica is testing Paul's ability to wield the voice, which is one of the powers a Bene Gesserit can command. He's just okay at it. He's pretty good at it. He's, give me the water. And she just kind of thinks about giving him the water. I will say, really cool effect here in which you can hear multiple voices mixed in with Paul's voice. Paul, of course, played by the very engaging, very charming, very talented Timothée Chalamet. And this is a cool reference point for some of the powers that the Bene Gesserit can command. Later, the Emperor's representatives, in a super cool, very epic scene, flanked by members of the Imperial Court who look like space DJs, and members of the Spacing Guild with their helmets, spice-filled helmets, and a representative of the Bene Gesserit, arrive on world, on Caladan, to officially present House Atreides and Duke Leto with the governorship of Arrakis. It's a big deal. Of course, Duke Leto accepts. Duncan Idaho, Jason Momoa, hey man. First of all, Duncan Idaho, any Jason Momoa character is like just a cool, rad dude. You know what I mean? And that's his range is like, I'm a cool, rad dude. I ride a motorcycle. I'm awesome. And nobody plays that character better than Jason Momoa. Duncan Idaho returns from a test flight. He will be heading to Arrakis soon on a secret cool dude diplomatic mission. Paul is like, I want to go. Can I go? Listen, here's my pitch. I want to go with you on a very dangerous mission to Arrakis. And he tells Duncan of his dream that he has seen Duncan dead after a violent fight. And Duncan is like, whatever, dude, don't worry. I'm fine. And also, no, you can't go. Later, Paul makes his pitch to Dad that he should go to Arrakis. I'd be an asset. I speak the Fremen language. They need me over there. Duke Leto's like, hard no. No, are you fucking crazy? The Duke then tells his son, listen, we're in a dangerous spot here. House Atreides, our influence amongst the Landsraad, which is the galaxy's great houses, how they are collectively known as the Landsraad, is very threatening to the Emperor. We're on the rise right now. The Emperor hates it. Sidebar, here's why the Emperor is so threatened by House Atreides, in case that wasn't clear. I had some friends asking me, like, what is the Emperor's game here? So House Atreides employs Thufir Hawat, who is a Mentat, the Duke's Mentat. He is famed across the galaxy for his brilliance as a strategist. He is super, super, super capable, very dangerous. War Master Gurney Halleck, who the Duke saved from Harkonnen slavery, along with Weapon Master Duncan Idaho, have built the Atreides military into a force that is just a hair's breadth as good as the Emperor's shock troops, the feared Sardukar. Now, the Emperor hopes that by placing House Atreides and House Harkonnen on a path to war, he can weaken both houses and keep his hands clean in the process of doing such, because he doesn't want to alarm the Landsraad that it's possible that the Emperor could like go out and target the great houses one by one. He doesn't want that to be known. But if he can start a war amongst the great houses, that benefits him. The Duke wants Paul at his side as he starts planning, you know, his strategy for Arrakis, his strategy for building desert power, learning what it means to lead. He doesn't want Paul going off on his own. We go to Geaty Prime, which is the homeworld of the brutal, ruthless, dangerous House Harkonnen. Beast Raban arrives before his uncle, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, and Raban is pretty pissed about having to leave Arrakis. He's mad about it. How could the Emperor take this promotion and give it to the Duke? He's very, very angry. And from this scene, which I think is also really well done, this is like some of the best exposition that you will see in a movie or television. Because everything is telling us about who these characters are and what's going on. We understand from this that Raban is a vicious autocrat, but probably not the smartest guy, more of a sledgehammer than a scalpel, because the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen then who is sitting there like Colonel Kurtz getting steamed like a dumpling, then has to tell Beast Raban, okay, here's what's going on, you fucking idiot. When is a gift not a gift? We go to Caladan. Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Moheim, the Imperial Truthsayer, arrives. She is Lady Jessica's former teacher. She arrives in the dead of night, so clearly this is not an official trip. She wants to examine Paul and learn more about these dreams that he's been having. Clearly, Lady Jessica has been informing her former teacher about Paul. Dr. Yue, the house physician, tells Paul, hey, here's what's going on, man. The Bene Gesserit have their own agenda, and so they want to see if you mean anything to that agenda. What that agenda is this. For centuries, for thousands of years, generations, the Bene Gesserit have been running a project of selective breeding amongst the great houses through which they hope to bring about the birth of the Kwisatz Haderach. More about who that person is later. And they think that might be Paul. This is a sort of a mild disaster for the Bene Gesserit because it really shouldn't be Paul. Jessica was supposed to give Duke Leto a daughter who would then go on to become the mother of the Kwisatz Haderach. But Jessica fell whole ass in love with that little cutie Duke Leto played by Oscar Isaacs. And you get it, right? And so she wanted to make her man happy. And the one thing he really wanted and in fact needed was a son. And so she gave that to him. The Bene Gesserits have complete command of their physiology. They are able to do things such as that, which like decide the sex of the child that they're going to bear. Rev Moheim tests Paul. And thanks to Jessica's training and the fact that he is, spoiler, is the KH, he passes. He then tells Rev Mo about his dreams, and later, that's the Reverend Mother. The Reverend Mother I'm calling Rev Mo. Later, Jessica tells Paul about the Kwisatz Haderach. So the Kwisatz Haderach is a little complicated because of the way that entity interacts with the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, but let's just say this. While the Bene Gesserit have some ability to predict the future and an ability to understand everything that has happened before because they can access the genetic memories of sisters that came before them, the Kwisatz Haderach can access highly accurate long-range prescience in a way that the Bene Gesserit can't. And this figure was supposed to be a child of an Atreides and a Harkonnen, which would unify those two great houses who were, or as we have learned, rivals. And that would bring about a period of peace and stability, which is what the Bene Gesserit want. They're out here shaping history. We go to Arrakis. House Atreides makes landfall to a really like awesome and epic bagpipe theme. We learn that the Harkonnens have left spies. They have left death traps behind them. But Thufir Hawat reports, listen, we're mopping up right now, but basically it's secure. Fremen onlookers who are watching in the distance chant, Lisan al-Ghaib, Lisan al-Ghaib, who is basically their legend of a messiah, the speaker of truth at Paul. They feel that he fits a lot of the details of this legendary Lisan al-Ghaib. This is the result of another of the Bene Gesserit's long-running projects, the Mishnah Proctiva, which is the planting of religious legends amongst native populations across the galaxy. This is part of the way that they shape history and steer history towards the ends that they desire. again, Paul Atreides seems to fit those signs of a messiah in the eyes of the Fremen. Later, Duke Leto and Gurney survey their new fief. Bottom line, they're pretty vulnerable out here, and the spice gotta flow. That's the thing. It's so valuable. You need the spice. Everybody needs the spice. The Bene Gesserit needs the spice. The Spacing Guild needs the spice. We need lots of spice. It only comes from Arrakis, and it can't stop, no matter what. Or House Atreides is in deep shit. Lady Jessica is interviewing prospective domestics. She receives a Chris knife from one of these prospective domestics named Shadout Mapes, who is a Fremen. She gets herself hired, and it's clear that Shadout really believes, oh my God, these are the signs. The time is coming. The Lysan Al Gaib is here. This is the mother of the Lysan Al Gaib who I am talking to. I'm very emotional. Mapes clearly believes Paul is the one. Later, Paul saves Mapes from getting stuck by a Harkonnen hunter seeker that was clearly meant for him. Thufir Hawat is like, oh my God, Duke, I am so sorry. I missed that honor seeker. I quit. I resign. My honor demands that I must resign. And then Duke is like, are you fucking kidding? You're a mentat. We need you right now. No, go find spies. We go back to Giedi Prime. The Revmo brings a message from the Emperor. The Emperor will send his Sardaukar shock troops, the most feared, best fighting troops in the entire galaxy, to augment the Harkonnens when they launch their sneak attack on Arrakis. Here's what the Emperor needs. Basically, anything goes. Kill anybody you want. But the attack must remain top secret. The Emperor's hands must never appear dirty in this. And Lady Jessica and Paul must live. And because this message is being carried by the Reverend Mother, Bene Gesserit, truthsayer to the Emperor, she will know if they are lying. The Baron pledges his word that no harm will come to them. This is a dangerous tactic by the Baron, which his twisted mentat, Peter DeVries, tells him, hey, listen, like, they'll know if you're lying. More on this later with the Dune Pod Boys. We go back to Arrakis. Now, listen, the Harkonnens got super rich on Arrakis, but they have left House Atreides some really tough infrastructure. Like, everything is broken down and fucked up. The Duke is like, let me go see this mining operation on which my entire fate and the fate of my house depends. He also wants to bring Liet Kynes, the Emperor's judge of the change, along. This is the person who is observing the change over for the Emperor to make sure everything is above board. Although clearly she has certain orders from the Emperor, and the Emperor is a biased observer who is actively trying to bring along the downfall of House Atreides. So clearly Liet Kynes is struggling with this, although she very clearly feels an affinity for House Atreides because, one, they're honorable, and two, maybe Paul is the Lysan Al Gaib. Anyway, Duncan comes home from mission. He has brought Stilgar, Fremen leader, with him, and he brings good news that, hey, listen, there's a lot of Fremen out here. There are a lot of them, more than previously understood, and listen, they are stealthy, they are secretive, and the Fremen are very, very skilled at war, which plays into Duke Leto's plans because he wants to ally with the Fremen. After the ritual spit handshake, the meeting goes pretty good. Stilgar catches some Lysan Al Gaib vibes from Paul, and he leaves. Later, Dr. Keynes arrives, and she's like, holy shit, Paul, have you worn a steel suit before? The boots. The boots with the fur. You're wearing it all correctly. Are you kidding me? Aside here, using whatever space Google they have, you could argue that House Atreides and Paul could have just Googled, how do I wear a steel suit? But of course, that's not what they did. Paul just understood how to do it. And Dr. Keynes getting those Lysan Al Gaib vibes. They go off to watch the spice mining operation. It goes very badly because of the poor state of the equipment. The Harkonnens left, and the Duke has to then rescue these miners from an attacking, rampaging sandworm. What about the spice? The Duke is asked, damn the spice! He cares about the people, the personnel. And from this, we understand that Duke Leto is just a good dude, right? Yes, the spice is important. The destiny of his house, you know, rests on the spice. But like, he cares about human life. He cares about people. Paul, out on the sands of Arrakis, has a strong reaction to the airborne spice, and he nearly buys it by the worm. Later, full on tripping fucking balls because of the spice, Paul talking to his mother, Lady Jessica, is like, man, I am losing it because of this spice. I put on some music, put on the black light. By the way, Mom, I know you're pregnant. And Lady Jessica is like, oh, shit. We go to Seleucus Secundus. Side note here and some information about Seleucus Secundus. So, to the galaxy. As far as the galaxy is concerned, Seleucus Secundus is where the Emperor sends prisoners. That's the Emperor's prison planet. It has, like, very, very strong gravity and a very, very brutal environment. And prisoners who go there mostly die, but the ones who survive get very strong. That's the official story. The unofficial story, the real story, is that this is where the Emperor trains his Sardaukar. Because of that harsh environment and that stronger gravity, the troops that are trained there, one, suffer immense casualties. Like, I think it's around 50% of the troops that are trained there don't make it. They die. The ones that live become super, super capable, super strong because of that higher gravity, because of that ruthless training. They are just incredibly, incredibly brutal. The best military troops in the galaxy. And they are absolutely maniacally, fanatically loyal to the Emperor, almost on a religious level. They'll do whatever the Emperor says. And they are not just military shock troops, but they are very, very skilled at counterintelligence, insurgency. They are very competent and feared spies. If the Emperor wants to send someone undercover, right, with smugglers, say, he will send his Sardaukar to go undercover and to infiltrate different groups just to find out what's going on. So on Seleucus Secundus, we see Peter DeVries, Baron Harkonnen's Twisted Mentat, making the deal with the Sardaukar that the Sardaukar will send battalions of troops to support the Harkonnens. And the leader of the Sardaukar says, if the Emperor commands it, we will do it. We go back to Arrakis. Jessica is like, my husband, Duke Leto, I have to tell you about our son who is tripping absolute nuts on spice. And I got to tell you what's going on with him because it's a long story and it involves the Bene Gesserit. And Duke Leto's like, I don't want to fucking hear it, okay? I want to know one thing. Will the Bene Gesserit protect Paul? And Lady Jessica's like, what? Why are you acting so crazy? Red flag! Lady Jessica doesn't answer. She's just like, why are you being so weird? Later that night, the Harkonnens attack. Uh-oh, Dr. Yue. And here is where I will say that I'm not super thrilled that the only main Asian in the cast is the betrayer, but that's fine. Dr. Yue, acting against his supposedly unbreakable conditioning, which they don't really explain in the movie, but in the book, this is not supposed to be possible, that a trained physician of a great house would turn against his employers, betrays House Atreides and lowers the defensive shields. The Baron's victory is essentially total. Atreides' military strength wiped out every city on the face of the planet hit at once. But Paul and Jessica have escaped. Separately, Duncan Idaho has also escaped. And others have also escaped, which will be revealed later. But other very important people have also escaped. The Duke, with his last breath, nearly takes out the leering, victorious Baron Harkonnen using Dr. Yue's poisoned tooth. Paul has a spice vision of himself at the head of a Fremen army, continuing to trip balls. He sees the galaxy aflame. He sees war. Later, Dr. Kynes and Duncan find them. But before the group can escape to a Fremen siege, the Sardaukar fall upon them. Duncan Idaho sacrifices himself so Jessica and Paul can escape. And Liet Kynes falls as well. Elsewhere, Raban reports to the Baron that Paul and Jessica are 100% dead. Definitely, they're gone. They are dead. They flew into a sandstorm. And you know what happens then. People get killed who do that. That's it. Don't worry about it. Baron Harkonnen, who is recovering from the poison tooth attack in a bath of balsamic and olive oil is like great. That's great news, my nephew. Now, let's take as much spice out of the planet as we can while wiping out the Fremen. Complete Fremen genocide. Go do it, the Beast Raban. And you know, because his nickname is the Beast, that that's the right guy to do a job like that. Now, aside, this is part of the Baron's plan. The Baron doesn't really want Raban to inherit House Harkonnen. He would prefer his favored nephew, Fade Rautha, who is not in this movie, but will surely appear in a sequel, should a sequel be made. More on that later. The smarter Fade Rautha, he would prefer to come to power. So the Baron's plan is set the Beast Raban loose on Arrakis, have him basically be absolutely hated by everyone, brutal and hated and feared. And then I bring in the pinch hitter, Fade Rautha, who is smarter and more competent. And everyone is like, wow, this guy's great. What a savior Fade Rautha is. And that's the Baron's plan. We go to the deep desert. Paul and Jessica, after the sandstorm, are walking across the desert. They come to a large outcrop, fleeing a worm. There they are met by a band of Fremen led by Stilgar. And after a brief fight in which Lady Jessica shows that she is not to be fucked with at all, she is a sister of the Bene Gesserit, and she is trained in combat, and she can use the voice and all this shit, Stilgar accepts them into his siege. He puts his name upon them. Unfortunately, Jamis, who Paul has had visions of, challenges Jessica to a ritual duel for leadership, and he says, who's going to be this woman's champion? Stilgar's like, don't do this, Jamis. What the fuck, man? But Jamis is like, no, I'm doing it. Who's going to be this person's champion? And Paul is like, well, I guess it's me. Guess what? Paul is good at fighting, even though he doesn't really want to kill because he's never killed a man. He's good at it. He's been trained by some of the best. And he slays Jamis and he prevails. Also, he meets Chaney, who he has been dreaming about, and the movie ends. On to Dune Part 2. Should say, I loved the little move that Paul uses to slay Jamis is like this little bullfighter move. And we understand that bullfighting is an important part of Atreides culture. Moving on, this movie, Rotten Tomatoes, 84% critics, 91% fresh by audience. So that's good reviews. That's great. Domestic box office so far, $40 million. International, $180 million. Worldwide, $220 million. So looking good as we go for a sequel. Some notable reviews, Richard Brody in The New Yorker with a pan. It's surprising how cheesy the new Dune looks. Richard Brody opens his review with, I gotta tell you, I fucking disagree. I love the epic scope of this. Bob Mondello in the NPR, cinematic sandcastles as impressive as Villeneuve's Dune don't come often. Manola Dargis, The New York Times. Villeneuve has made a serious stately opus, and while he doesn't have a pop bone in his body, he knows how to put on a show as he fans a timely argument about who gets to play the hero now. I love the movie. I think it's super weird. And I love that it maintains that super weird, psychedelic, teenager tripping on hallucinogens in the desert vibe that is so present in the books and is so important to the books. That said, I'm super fascinated to know what people think of it, how it hits them, because it is definitely weirder and more artistic than your standard sci-fi epic popcorn movie. When we come back, I'll be joined by Dune Pod guys Jason and H.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. When Dr. Sabah and I decided to do a skincare line together, he said to me, "We are going to give women meaningful beauty." And I said, "That's exactly right. We want to give women meaningful beauty, which means each and every product is meaningful. It has a reason to exist. It's efficacious. You're going to get results. And then you just go out and live your life."
Meaningful Beauty. Confidence is beautiful. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Welcome to the Airlock, where today I'm thrilled to be joined by the Dune Pod! Boys, Jason Goldman and H. Fantastic to have you on the podcast. Welcome. How are you?
Thanks for cutting a new intro for us there. That's just going to be what we use from now on. So
it's great to be here.
Yeah. We're going to do the whole interview in starter car.
Yeah. Oh, man. So this is, listen, we'll get into it in a second. But I was just, I rewound the starter car intro scene, like on Secundus.
Seleucus
a million
Secundus.
Times, yeah. Seleucus yeah. Secundus, because I just was like, oh, it's cool that their speech is like weird mutated English that is like, you know, because his last line is like, if the Hebrew commanded, adada, yeah. Which is like almost English, kind of.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, it's like in the future, like 20,000 years from now, like there's like a Viking race that developed an extra larynx to like be able to make those sounds. Like that was a key evolutionary advantage that people.
Well, it's that heavy gravity on that planet. Yeah. It's just like melting your throat vocal cords.
Yeah. Also being hung stronger. Upside down in a crucifixion field is not great for the.
For a long, long time. That's part of the training, folks. And yeah. I don't know what that does, but it makes you really good at fighting. You guys do the Dune Pod. What'd you think of the movie Dune?
Go ahead, Jay. You start.
We like this movie, it turns out. We started the podcast when we thought the movie was coming out in 2020, and then we've been vamping for a year because it got pushed back due to the pandemic. So we had a lot riding on it being good because the podcast would have been a bit of a downer after 18 months. I was just like, it was aight, but it's great.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
But it's great. The movie's great.
It's incredible. You know, this exceeded expectations in just about every way. And part of it from the very beginning, I got excited about starting this podcast because Jason was freaking out every time Denny and Dune was being mentioned. And we knew that what he was going to bring to it was this seriousness, this grounded filmmaking that was going to work in this epic scale. And in that respect, it's been perfect.
Yeah, the epicness of it is so important. Listen, the Lynch version was also epic in its way, obviously, with 1980s special effects. Yep. So it looks super weird now, but they definitely went for the epic scale. But this really does it in a way that recalls to me, you know, like Lawrence of Arabia or The Searchers or like a great Western where it's just characters dwarfed by the landscape, by the immense machinery they're around. Villeneuve does this really cool thing with like, with focus where it's almost like he crops in and zooms in almost with characters falling out of frame because it's almost like the screen can't take in all the stuff that is happening there. It's a really cool effect. I was blown away by it. I love that it maintains the weirdness of the book. How do you think people who aren't Dune heads will be hit by this movie?
I mean, that's been the coolest thing about the movie finally coming out is that it has created a cultural moment of people vibing with the movie who clearly haven't read the book, who are not, you know, sort of in the bag for Dune. And I think what folks take away from it, like, and we have folks in our lives who are in that camp, is just the, there's like, oh, there's a whole world here to explore. Yeah. Like there's something new and fresh here that I want to see more stories from. And so the number of people who haven't read the book and who are now hungry for part two, because they're like, I just want to hear more of this right now, is really encouraging.
I gauged it off a neighbor of mine who had no experience whatsoever. And she was just like, this is incredible. It was so, we saw it in IMAX. And she's like, I just couldn't believe what I was seeing on screen. And I got everything about, there's like a prophetic thing and a Messiah situation that doesn't sound real good. She's like, I was a little confused by the shields, but
that
other than that.
Sound real good.
Oh. So I'll take that. I'll take getting the prophetic, but missing the shield, you know, blue versus red. Like that's fine.
Let's come back to the shields because that was one of the first things that I DM'd to Jason after seeing the film. We can get to that small nitpick there. What's your relationship to this story? Where did it find you in your lives? You know, how did you first encounter it?
Well, my brother turned me on to Dune when I was 11 years old. This was back in the early 80s. And I, as a young kid, I took a trip to California and I took Dune with me on the plane. And I read the first three books many times, saw the Lynch film in the theater where they actually had a glossary term sheet that they handed out to.
Yeah.
Crazy. But so I was like, I've been a fan my whole life, although I strangely skipped both sci-fi miniseries until this year.
Get out of my mind!
Exactly.
That's what spoke to H as a young child. He wanted, he felt that there was someone in his mind. And he just needed to find the language to get
No, similar to Denny, I was very much seduced by the power of Paul and the idea of a young, you know, a teenager that was able to exercise such control and then influence out in the world. That was very seductive.
And I think, you know, when we talk to folks who have a history with Dune, there's actually, it's usually a common story where it kind of is like, sort of like Joy Division for precocious young nerds. Like at age 13, like an older brother turns you on to this and is like, hey man, you want to have your mind blown? This has got worms in it. And like, you know, it's and like, there's just something about, it's the boy goes on a journey story, but it's just much weirder than, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia or whatever your analogs were before then.
Yeah. For me, I think, you know, I found it in high school. And so for me, it was like, there's something about the revelation that parents have these secret lives and these secret ambitions and these, you know, things that they have planned out that they are acting on lives before you came into their life, and that those can often be quite complicated. That part of it, that like emotional register, I found really compelling. And I loved all the planning and all the strategy and the way that people were all plotting against each other all the time. And you know, in the context of high school life, that felt like really present. So I was absolutely transfixed by the first book, which I think is the most tropey of the books. Certainly, mm-hmm. like, you know, the hero's journey, the whole thing, that is there. That is the path that Paul is on. This book series subverts itself in some pretty yeah. dramatic ways, yeah. which I don't yeah. know how much we want to talk about right now. I, you know, there's a spoiler warning at the top of this. But suffice to say, Frank Herbert was very, very distrustful of power. Mm-hmm. And people who get power in this world don't become good people. They're, right. And so how do you think, should we get the sequels? And I'm very hopeful that I think we will get them. How far do you think we can go down that path of actually power is bad and let's subvert every expectation you have about this sweeping story about a boy who rises to prominence in the galaxy?
I think you nailed like the really interesting thing about it, which is that Dune in 1965 in many ways is both Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones. It's both like the treasure trove of tropes that trickle down through the history of science fiction thereafter. But then it is also the subversion of the genre and the right. subversion of those tropes in one story. And Herbert definitely believed that it's not that power corrupts, but that power attracts the corruptible.
Right.
And so his project really is a warning about heroes. And there's this line in a book about how no more terrible fate could befall your people than to fall into the hands of a hero. And we asked Villeneuve about this. This was our question. It was like, are you in for this? Because this seems weird. This seems like a tough story to sell. And he seems super down. Like he really wants to make part two. And he's talked about making Messiah, which would be the book after Dune, as a trilogy, which is very much this trajectory of
yep.
a person who's attracted to power being inherently corruptible.
I think it's interesting. When we talked to Tim O'Reilly last year, one of the things that when he interviewed Frank, when he was writing the book on him, Frank called out that when he read Foundation, and he saw the mule, he was like, well, this is interesting. What if the mule was the hero of the story instead of the villain of the story?
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'll talk about this in my omnibus segment later, but I think that one way to think about Dune is a conversation between Frank Herbert and Asimov. I think that yeah. Dune is in a lot of ways a rebuttal and a criticism of Foundation's depiction of imperial power throughout the galaxy and what that would
right.
what that would mean. Let's talk about the shields. I think that if I have a nitpick about this movie, and I loved everything, I love the casting. I think is impeccable,
incredible.
I the performances are unbelievable. I think Timothy Chalamet. I had a big argument with a friend about like, oh, Chalamet, he's just like cute. He's not good. I'm like, he's a fucking great actor. Like, he's really good. When he has the hand in the box, in the pain box, and he first gets that first tickle of pain, yeah. he does this little smirk like, mm-hmm. oh, I see what you're doing. You're mm-hmm. going to make me feel pain in my hand now. And that's the kind of shit that he could do that nobody else can really do. These little, like, looks and, like, where you understand that this is a child of wealth. Above all else, like, yes, he is an innately good kid who loves his family, but like he's got that little imperiousness to him too, and he just kills it. I loved everything except the shields. Okay, so in the books, shield fighting is super important. So people are like, you know, a lot of people come up to me like, okay, so this is like 20,000 years in the future. Where are the guns? Where are the laser beams? Where's all the shit? Shield fighting has changed the way people fight. There's also a wide ban on, you know, atomic weapons. But the shields stop everything that comes in at pace. You have to move in very slowly with a blade in order to penetrate into the shield. And this is important because this colors the way Paul duels, even without the shield, which comes in is important later because he's able to see, oh, this is a person who I'm fighting a person who's used to fighting with shields. Therefore, the reaction time is different. I didn't love the way that it was. Listen, the red and blue to let you know, okay, blue repelled by the shield, red, it gets in there. Fine, that's good. That was necessary. But at the same time, like when Duncan Idaho is going apeshit on the Sardaukar, he's just yeah. like slashing them and they just die.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, there's some where he's like he hits and there's yeah. a blue flash, but then he right. keeps the blade and then drags it. And then you get a red flash. So I think there is some that they did. Jason and I were calling out, for us, the bigger challenge was in the larger scenes, like when you had the amazing 300 style scene with the Atreides on the steps.
Atreides!
Exactly. But once they collide, and we actually sampled it for the episode, like all you can hear is shield smashing and you can't really tell what's going on.
Yeah. And then the duel at the end without shields is clearly the best fight in the movie because you can see what's going on. So I think that's ultimately what proves your point, is that the visual effect of the shield, while like conceptually cool, it obscures the action in a way that doesn't really enhance what's going on, but is a necessary plot point for them to figure out some way to do.
Did you catch Paul's finishing move on Jamis was like a little bullfighter swirl?
I absolutely love that.
Didn't catch that. That's great. That's amazing.
A pretty good the bullfighting, which is in the book, like that the grandfather dies in a bullfight, is like sort of a one line thing, and they really went with it in the movie.
I love
that. It's all about bulls.
It's all about. Listen, we're Scottish kind of with the bagpipes, but also we've got Spanish. This bullfighting thing. Very important.
Yeah.
Another musical. Just jumping around. Another musical cue that I really enjoyed with the depiction of the Harkonnens as Baron Harkonnen is lording in his victory, is like just enjoying it. We get this very Russian national anthem kind of swelling Harkonnen theme, which to me seemed like a reference to the fact that Frank Herbert, notably, not a fan of the Soviet Union.
No.
He modeled these characters after the Soviets.
Yeah.
Tell us about the
Harkonnens. They're brutal! They're brutal!
I mean, the Baron Harkonnen's first name is Vladimir, which is kind of is a bit of a clue. So Frank Herbert's politics was, you know, he really didn't like Kennedy, was really worried about JFK being such a charismatic leader and what that
would
mean
for people being seduced by power. We'd call him a libertarian now, wouldn't we?
What's that?
We'd call him a libertarian now. Do you think?
Yeah, he'd be way into the coins. He'd have his own, he'd have Spice Coin for sure. For 100%, isn't in later books has a lot to say about taxation as theft. Notably, after he had made a lot of money, he literally came out against taxation. He had his house on Maui and was like, you know what the ultimate evil in the galaxy is?
Yeah.
Taxes.
Princess Irulan, dispatch on taxes.
Yeah. The Snipes Manifesto. He really didn't believe in communism for sure. That he didn't believe in technocrats either. He didn't believe in any sort of bureaucracy where people could not have a direct say in what happened to them. The sort of the government that he believes in ultimately is direct juries, where like, you know, people just vote directly on what laws they think should exist, which is a terrible idea. That's what he was going for.
I had a friend of mine be like, wait a second. So what is the emperor wants the Atreides out of the way, but also gave them like a really cool planet? Fellas, talk people through exactly what the emperor is seeing, like on the strategy table. And so what the emperor's larger plan is here.
Well, sort of foundationally, you have this notion of the Lanzarad, which is the collection of the great houses. And they are also shareholders in the sort of financial structure of the Imperium. Right. And the emperor controls like 42% or 48% or something like that. And so the concept is he's always trying to maintain this balance of financial power to keep the different houses in line. And so Leto calls out that the great houses look to us for leadership. And if we can do this, we'll become more powerful than ever. So he is a little thirsty for power in the midst of this. He's not just there to like hang out with the Fremen.
Right. He's just like, I love the Fremen. I love the desert. I'm just like
love
a nice
culture.
Guy. Yeah, it's great.
Want to meet that little mouse?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
So it is a little bit more complicated, but essentially this was the emperor's notion of pitting the Atreides and the Harkonnens against each other and ultimately damaging both of them. It just didn't turn out quite the way they expected.
It's interesting to me when Baron Harkonnen is able to say, Lady Jessica and Paul, they're going to be, don't worry about it. 100% fine. I guarantee it.
Right.
Now, listen, you could nitpick any sci-fi story, but wouldn't the truthsayer be like, that's a lie?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about that is, like, there's this concept, like, that people don't want to face a truthsayer, so they throw them out in the desert and they don't kill them, which is based on the belief that the truthsayer is only going to ask the question, like, did you directly kill this person?
Right.
They say no, and there are no follow-ups. There's no second question whatsoever.
Like, everything appears to be in order here.
When was the last time you saw them? Like, you know, were they in good health the last time you saw them? Did you give them a ride to somewhere chill? No follow-up questions asked by the truthsayer.
So the Harkonnens are, as Gurney Halleck tells us, they're brutal. And I actually love that line reading.
Yeah.
Because listen, there's not enough time for the backstory of Gurney Halleck, but he has experience with them, as he says there, and as you can tell by the emotion in his voice. Tell the audience what it is. Why is Bernie so fired up about these Harkonnens?
So as is the case with most of the Atreides who are loyal to the family, whether that's Gurney or Duncan or Dr. Yui even, they've suffered in some ways at the hands of the Harkonnens. And Gurney's family in particular was killed by Harkonnens, and he has a scar on his face that was given to him by the Beast Robin. You see in the opening prologue, the Beast carrying this ink vine whip, and that whip was used to scar Gurney in a time before the beginning of the story in the movie.
And you don't get a showdown between Gurney and Raban in the book. And I think this is maybe a good time to talk about, like, Denny has made a number of changes from the book to the movie. And
yes,
almost
changed it. I've adapted it to the screen. It's not exactly as the book. It's magnifique.
But almost every one of them is amazing. Like the idea of, instead of having this boring Irulan intro, you have Chani, you know, giving it from the Fremen perspective and anchoring it right there. It's just like super smart.
Yeah, I like the epigram openings, chapter openings in the book. I think are really cool. Lynch tried to adapt those, and they didn't really work. It pretty much killed the momentum, and I love that they are not in this. Let's talk about. Let's give the people kind of like a context on some who these figures are and what they mean to the galaxy. So, Thufir Hawat and Peter DeVries, the mentats that work for House Atreides and House Harkonnen, respectively. Who are they? What is a mentat? And Peter in particular, we don't get a lot of time with. RIP to him. But tell us who these people are and what their importance is.
So 10,000 years before the events of the movie, there was an event called the Butlerian Jihad, in which an out-of-control artificial intelligence threatened the continued existence of humankind. And the humans won, and this is what established the reign of the Padishah Emperor and the Carino family. But they decided to never again make that mistake and banned all thinking machines. So there are no computers in the world of Dune. And there's an explicit prohibition against any technology that could resemble the functioning of a human mind. And so as a result, they have developed humans that are thinking computers. And these are mentats. And they go to a special training from a very young age, and they learn how to do this type of computation that you would otherwise rely on a computer for. And so when you see the mentat's eyes roll back, that's Villeneuve's cue that they're doing, you know, some kind of teraflop computation in their heads.
But they were pretty sidelined in this film. And the other piece that's in the book that was basically excised is that Paul has been trained as a mentat as well. I had forgotten that until we reread it last year. And I was like, oh, holy shit.
He's a mentat Bene Gesserit. So it's
exactly. He's got it all. He's dual
class. The chocolate and the peanut butter together.
Yeah. He got extra ability points at the beginning of his round. Yeah.
OP.
Yeah.
Peter DeVries, who is the mentat of the Harkonnens, I should add that Thufir Hawat is like a famous mentat. Like this is one of the best, most feared, most capable, most intelligent mentats out there. He is a huge part of the success of House Atreides. The reason that the Lansrad looks to House Atreides is in part because of
Don't be fooled by the parasol. He's got other tricks besides
in part that. Because of how good Thufir is at his job. Yeah. And then his mirror image is Peter DeVries, who is in the books known as a twisted mentat. So what is who is he? What is his deal?
The twisted mentats, there's this notion of there's a branch called the Bene Tleilax, and they are sort of like these specialists in breeding programs and these different alternate techniques of things. And they have a separate program from the main mentat training program where they're basically making their own mentats who are... Part of it is not just the computation, but also the sort of tapping into deeper consciousness and universal elements. And so you end up with some that get broken and are willing to use their powers for bad. And that's basically Piter's like the poster child of that. He's like the ultimate twisted mentat.
Yeah, the Bene Tleilax, they will bring you gifts and the gifts will be weird.
Should we talk? Should we talk weird? Which while we're talking Harkonnen, should we talk the spider thing? Are you ready?
Yeah, let's talk about the spider. Yeah.
So the spider is completely extratextual. There's no spider. There's no spider in the book. There's a scene in the movie in which it's the Reverend Mother Peter DeVries and the Baron, and there's a spider creature in the background grubbing on some bowl of stuff, and the Reverend Mother dismisses it with the voice.
I don't want to talk to you with a spider around
that has human hands. Up.
It has human hands. And is in fact portrayed by a human woman. The performer of the spider is credited, see her do this like spider dance. It's like, you know, they got the top spider lady available to do this. And so there's a lot of fan speculation about what this means and why is this in there. And it should just be noted that it's possible that Denis Villeneuve has a spider fetish. He's got a whole movie.
I love the arachnid spider.
With all the legs, they are so sexy.
Legs, incredible. Eight eyes is unbelievable.
So he has a movie Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal in which spiders are an object of sexual fascination. So that just might be his thing. The theory that we like, that we and others have arrived at independently, is that the spider is either a Harkonnen or Bene Tleilax body torture of someone, or specifically Dr. Yui's wife, Juana, because he mentions that she's being torn apart like a doll. And it's possible that they're just doing some, you know, Tusk style body horror stuff, turning people into bugs and other creatures.
So, yeah, and we should call out the Bene Tleilax as it develops through the series. It's revealed that once someone dies, they can actually take their cells and they can regrow that person and bring them back. So perhaps Juana has been brought back as this spider human thing that is crawling around there.
The Golas. And if we get there, get ready for some weird Gola action. You mentioned Dr. Yue. And it's not really a big thing in the movie, but it is supposed to be not possible to turn someone who has undergone the imperial conditioning, as Dr. Wellington Yue has, against their employer, against their house. Why was that able to be done? And tell us about that conditioning, why this is such a big deal, and why this was such a blind spot for House Atreides. It's not supposed to be a thing that anyone can do.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that's in a lot of Dune, is that there's this idea of deep psychological conditioning that people can go under that makes it impossible for them to do things or creates a vulnerability for them that they can be controlled with a word. And for this special class of doctors, the Sook doctors, they are trained and conditioned to not just take like a Hippocratic oath to do no harm, but are psychologically manipulated such that it is impossible for them to harm the people that they serve. And in doing so, are enabled to treat people like the emperor himself. Yui becomes corruptible because the Harkonnens have his wife, Juana, and his love for her and his anguish over what's happened to her, she's being tortured by them, overrides his conditioning such that he's able to be turned into a traitor.
It's a weird concept, but it reflects two things. One, the idea that poison and assassination is one of the most, because shields have made most types of warfare irrelevant, assassination and poison becomes really important. So the Sook doctors are really critical, trusted servants. The second piece is just, you have Duke Leto, who is this capable and together guy, and he's looking at everything, but you count on the sun rising every day and you count on your Sook doctor being trustworthy. So that just is a blind spot that it was impossible for him to be prepared for.
Are there any parts of this movie that just stood out as something you really didn't expect and really, really enjoyed? Like what was your favorite part of this movie, essentially?
I'll say my favorite part, and when we talked about the book in the very first episode of the podcast, we talked about the scene with Jessica and Paul in the tent at the end of book one as a favorite moment in the entire book. For me, that whole scene of how that unfolds and the fact that they don't flinch from the notion that there's scary business that is out there. And it's driven by Paul's initial reaction to the spice within the tent. Yeah. So you have this psychoactive aspect. But the shot of Paul and Chani in all black standing up on the ship looking down, that's
watching
just like
jihad, watching the jihad sweep across the galaxy.
Their jihad VIP viewing station.
That's incredible. To me, that's the highlight. That's the highlight of the whole movie.
Who is behind them in the ship? Because there's it's them at the like kind of the lip of the ramp, right? And then there's like two people behind. Who are the two people behind?
It's not clear. I thought one of them in the vision might have been Jameis again, which I want to talk about a bit. But then there's this idea that's established later, which is that Paul takes a group of Fremen and calls them the Fae Dakin, and they become his death commandos. So it's probably some of those bros that are just on his side.
Yeah, I would imagine Korba as well, who emerges as a critical player in Messiah. But this is an interesting thing, right? So what's happening right now, after we've been railing against this for the last year, and Denny famously kind of went to war for a while with Warner Brothers, the fact that this movie is available on HBO Max right now, so that we have this conversation and nerds all across the world are having this conversation, and they immediately can bring it up and they can watch it and they can look at it and they can screenshot it. Like, it's feeding into a cultural moment here that is, you know, bigger than we expected.
Yeah.
So Jason, you're a moment that you really enjoyed. And then let's talk about Jameis.
I love what they did with Jameis in this movie.
Like, me too.
Paul kills Jameis in this duel. That's like a big turning point for his character. It's the first time he kills someone, and it's this meaningful interaction, and it's a great duel. But what they do with the prescient visions is you see Jameis in the visions, and I think this does something that the book can't do, which is sell this idea of there's multiple timelines that Paul is seeing, and in some of them he dies, in some of them Jameis lives, in some of them Jameis becomes a friend and a teacher and is the one who's going to teach him how to ride the worm and is going to impart wisdom to him, and then in the one that Paul ultimately chooses, he kills Jameis. And so that, I think, is a much more convincing portrayal of prophecy and, you know, this multiverse idea of how Paul sees the future than some of the more kind of LSD laced writings of Herbert, where he's describing that kind of prescience, but it's a lot of like, you know, many sausages strung out in front of me and I picked the sausage I want to live in. And you're just like, bro, like I've heard enough about the sausages. Like, it's not helping.
Another similar to that, a thing that I thought was really brilliant. And again, I think he's done a great job of using small details, whether it be the sound design, the visual, whatever, to convey a larger thematic something that exists in the book, but do it in a way that is visceral. And one of those to me is the voice. So in the books, and this is not really explained in the movies, but the Bene Gesserit have access to the genetic memories of all the all the sisters who came before, everything that they know, a Bene Gesserit who exists in our story knows, can call upon that wisdom. And thus they're able to, with some accuracy, predict the future. Now the Kwisatz Haderach has access to the full memories and therefore can predict more. But the thing that I really liked was the way the voice modulates. It's Paul's voice, then it's the Reverend Mother's voice, then it's Jessica's voice, then it's Chani's voice. Chani's voice. Therefore, embodying that idea of genetic memory. I absolutely thought that was a brilliant way to do it. Could you explain to the people what the genetic memory is, how that works, and why the Kwisatz Haderach is a different kind of genetic memory?
Yeah, so the Bene Gesserit have this ability because they ingest a huge amount of spice. To access
everybody's just rocking float, spice just, nonstop.
Just an unbelievable amount. I mean,
and it's not park spice. This is good spice.
This is the good. This is not the park spice. This is the real shit. This is the pure spice that you want in your helmet. Just orbiting around your face all the time.
Now we know what Daft Punk was on.
Yeah.
So like because of their, you know, dank science, they're able to access these interior lives of previous sisters who have lived and basically converse with them, experience their memories. You know, there's a scene in a later book in which the Reverend Mother Superior, there's an acolyte who's not yet gone through this and she's reading Tolstoy. And the Reverend Mother is able to say, is like, oh, he actually wrote that while he was, you know, at his dacha, like sitting beside a stream. That's not written down anywhere. That's just something I know because I've got Tolstoy inside me. And so like there's this notion of accessing prior lives, but only women can do this in the Herbert universe. Only Reverend Mothers can go within and take this otherwise lethal dose of spice. And many Reverend Mothers die in trying to do this. Any man who has tried to do this dies. And there's the prophecy that the
Queen Sotara die.
They tried and died.
Yeah. So there's this prophecy that one day at Kwisatz Haderach, a male will come who's able to look inside and access this place that the Bene Gesserit are unable to look into and become the universe's super being. So that's what's going on with these prior lives inside. Mm.
Gentlemen, it has been delightful to spend this time with you. Please tell the audience about Dune Pod. And what it has. I gotta say, some of the vamping, incredibly enjoyable. Excalibur. I had Excalibur on VHS as a child.
Yes.
Should I have watched that movie? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Even the rated version is fucking crazy for a kid to watch. So I really enjoyed your pod on Excalibur, Anal Nathrak, Uthvasbethud. Tell us about Dune Pod. And what you have coming up next.
Yeah, I mean, so this podcast, we started it because we wanted to focus on the films by the cast and crew. So we started with Denny with 2049 and Arrival and Sicario. We did Call Me By Your Name with Timothée Chalamet. And as we've developed, we're focusing on films that are in the same genre or that we think are important. So the first thing to know is we talk about Dune every week, but we also don't only talk about Dune. So for instance, next week we have one of the directors of House of the Dragon, the new Game of Thrones show.
Hello.
Greg Yatanis is coming on to talk 12 Monkeys. And the week after that, we've got the showrunner, Ryan Condal from House of the Dragon to talk Aliens. And then 2001, the week after that. So if you like movies, if you like sci-fi, you know, come on and just hear these amazing conversations that we have of really why these films are important and a lot of fun.
Yeah, we've joked about like it's sort of become a Gen X genre movie podcast instead of Dune Pod, which has the advantage of being singable to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles song. So it's, you know, it's Gen X genre Next movie podcast. That's our new deal.
Once again, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we'll crack open the omnibus. Welcome to another chapter in the Omnibus, where lore, analysis, and understanding come together. This week, let's talk about space empires, the origin of the trope of the empire in space, and let's talk about, more specifically, Frank Herbert's Dune. Frank Herbert's Dune, published in 1965, built on the age-old storytelling tropes of the hero's journey and the space empire framework established by Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and combined them with Herbert's own interest in ecology and psychedelia to create something that was both very influential in the time that it was released in the 60s and is clearly, because of the recent released Denis Villeneuve film, something timeless. Dune won the inaugural 1966 Nebula Award for Best Sci-Fi Novel and shared the 1966 Hugo Award for Best Novel with Roger Zelazny's This Immortal, also called Call Me Conrad. Readers in the 60s and 70s were absolutely primed for Dune and for the themes of ecological destruction, mind-expanding substances, and charismatic revolutionary youth found in Herbert's epic story. Rachel Carson's scientific expose, Silent Spring, about the dangerous effects of wanton pesticide use on the environment, became a surprise hit in 1962 and kicked off the modern environmental movement and created the school of thought about what are humanity's effects on the environment. And of course, Dune's ecological message is even more keenly felt today in a world struggling to deal with climate change, struggling and failing. In 1965, concerns about the use of LSD by the general public led the Swiss pharmaceutical company Sandoz to halt production of its surely weirdest product. But by then, of course, the genie was all the way out of the bottle. Popular use of LSD or acid and other hallucinogens gave rise to the psychedelic movement of the 60s, which in turn gave that era its signature aesthetic texture, which of course is recognizable decades later. When you see tie-dye, you understand this is a reference to the 1960s. And the rise of global youth culture in the 60s, as the baby boomers came into their maturation and started to flex their economic and cultural muscles, placed young people at the center of a wide variety of conversations, conversations about social justice, conversations about higher education, conversations about fashion, about music, about art, about sexual mores, about drug use, and more. Dune sat astride all of these trends. Quote, "Word is spreading on the West Coast grapevine about an epic science fiction novel titled Dune," reads the April 6th, 1969 edition of the Boston Globe's nationally syndicated column Youth Notes, alongside short paragraphs on the poor reputation of the CIA amongst American youth, a two-paragraph write-up on the Peace Corps, and a profile of a then-emerging Texas singer named Janis Joplin. The review on Dune continues, quote, "Written by Frank Herbert, a California newspaperman, the book surpasses the work of British storyteller J.R. Tolkien as a feat of imagination." Now, you may agree or disagree on that, but I think that's quite indicative of the kind of hype that Dune had in the late 60s and early 70s. One of the under-discussed aspects of Dune is the way the story acts as a mirror reflection and a kind of rebuttal to Isaac Asimov's iconic legendary Foundation series. Foundation is generally credited with inventing the now familiar trope of the Galactic Empire, the trope popularized to a massive degree, of course, by Star Wars. Foundation first appeared as a series of short stories running in Astounding Magazine, which is a sci-fi magazine of the era from 1942 to 1950. The first four stories were published together in 1951 as the single volume book Foundation, which was then followed by the sequels Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation in 1952 and 53, respectively. Set 50,000 years in the future, Foundation tells the story of the last years of humanity's galactic empire, which by the opening of the tale spans some 25 million planets. Ultimate authority over those worlds rests in the hands of the Emperor, who resides on Trantor, the Imperial capital. But unbeknownst to the Emperor, his subjects, and essentially everyone in the galaxy, the Empire is crumbling and is in fact mortally wounded, already on its way out. Both Dune and Foundation are set many millennia in the future. Both deal with the stagnation of a galactic empire, the restoration of civilization, the role of charismatic leader in said restoration, and both prominently feature a highly advanced system for predicting future events that fuses math, religion, and human psychology. In Foundation, the character Harry Seldon alone, the most brilliant man in the galaxy, creator of the advanced mathematical predictive model known as psychohistory, realizes the dire state of the Empire. Just as in Dune, when the Emperor sends the Atreides to the far-flung planet of Arrakis. In Foundation, the Emperor exiles Harry and his followers to Terminus, a barren planet on the galactic fringe. This, of course, is all to Harry's larger plan. He had planned to get exiled there, and there, using science, using political maneuvering, using outright manipulation, and using semi-regular appearances as a kind of TED-talking hologram, Harry drives a multi-century project to guide the human race out of the post-imperial Dark Ages. Frank Herbert's answer to psychohistory in Dune comes in the forms of the quasi-religious sisterhood known as the Bene Gesserit and the human computers known as Mentats. The Bene Gesserits use carefully deployed religious myths, an extensive and secretive system of genetic crossbreeding, and their own enhanced abilities, particularly mind control, the ability to detect lies, and the ability to call on the collective wisdom of past Bene Gesserit sisters to shape human history and bring about the birth of the Kwisatz Haderach, Dune's version of the Chosen One. Mentats, like Dune's Thufir Hawat and Peter DeVries, are human supercomputers. They provide their employers with services that, in the days before the Butlerian Jihad, would be performed by a computer, while also using their highly attenuated perceptive abilities and understanding of human psychology to act as strategic advisors in military affairs, provide intelligence and counterintelligence, perform duties of diplomacy, and much more. In Foundation, Asimov imagines that placing a few unaccountable psychoanalysts at the center of immense power, as he does with Harry Seldon and the Foundation, and allowing them to steer humanity's fate according to a scientific reading of an advanced algorithm is potentially the best of all political systems. Foundation, in thought-provoking and very entertaining fashion, assumes that cold, emotionless, unbiased math is the best steward of humanity's destiny. Herbert, however, was a contrarian in all things, as Jason and H discussed, I think, quite ably in our previous segment. And he philosophically decried assumptions, even his own assumptions, much of the time, perhaps because of this. Dune sequels subvert themselves and audience expectation in many, many ways. This makes what will happen with the Dune sequels really interesting. I'm fascinated to see how some of those things end up playing out for audiences because people who are set up as heroes are undercut by this story. If you want a goldmine of science fiction material, Herbert advised, pull the assumptions out of the current bestseller list, turn those assumptions over, look at them from every angle you can imagine, tear them apart, put them back together. Put your new construction on another planet or on this planet changed and place believable human beings into the conflict thus created. In Herbert's view, any system which purports to be the system, be it psychohistory, be it religion, be it republicanism, whatever, will inevitably result in inefficiency, stagnation, decline, the stymieing of human creativity. Just as Duke Leto searched to harness desert power in Arrakis, Herbert explored the idea of harnessing human power. In Dune, human beings alone perform the computations necessary to sustain a transgalactic empire. The spice melange, a powerful psychoactive narcotic, makes this possible by allowing human beings to expand and augment their minds to superhuman levels. For a sci-fi epic set many thousands of years in the future, I think it's notable that Dune is really light on the kind of like, oh, wow, technology, incredible whiz-bang scientific sci-fi tech that marks most sci-fi. Guild Navigators, for instance, high on spice, fold space, without computer help. The most powerful space militaries in the galaxy fight with knives. And human society has essentially devolved into feudalism. Asimov hated this kind of scienceless sci-fi. In Robert Scholes and Eric S. Rabkin's 1977's Science Fiction, History, Science, and Vision, Asimov is quoted as saying, there are science fiction writers who think science is a bad thing and that science fiction is a wonderful field in which to make this plane. This is part of a much more general attitude that society is a bad thing and must be destroyed before a new and better system can be evolved. This may strike youngsters today as a daring and novel notion, but when my great-grandfather was a boy, they called it nihilism. Now, Asimov doesn't name-check Herbert here or Kurt Vonnegut or Ursula K. Le Guin or Gene Wolfe, but he is surely talking about that new wave of sci-fi writers who was rising at the time. Herbert's retort to this comes in his book Heretics of Dune, the fifth book in the series, in which he writes, "The holders of power in this world have not awakened to the realization that there is no single model of a society, a species, or an individual. There are a variety of models to meet a variety of needs. They meet different expectations and have different goals. The aim of that force which impels us to live may be to produce as many different models as possible," end quote. I don't know where you come down on this, but I think whatever style of sci-fi you prefer, whatever depiction of galactic empire you prefer, be it Dunes, be it Foundations, be it Star Wars's, it's clear that the winner of this debate is us, the audience, the fans of sci-fi who get to watch Foundation on television, Dune in the theaters, and Star Wars wherever we come into contact with content. Up next, The Endgame. Welcome to The Endgame, a segment in which myself and a co-host slash guest play a game. And today that guest is New York Times multiple best-selling author, writer of a show that has just been picked up by IMDb TV, my friend and former co-host, Shay Serrano, the man who accuses me of crimes almost daily on the internet. Shay, how are you? It's so great to be here with you.
I'm very happy to be back listening to your voice, introducing me like that. It makes me feel real good.
Shay, today we are recording this on a Tuesday, and it is a special day because it is the official release of your book, yes, Hip Hop and Other Things. Tell us about this book. Let's just talk about how awesome this book is.
This is the greatest book that's ever been written. Many people are saying that. Pretty much everybody.
Every place I go, people are talking about that. I went to get coffee today and people were talking about that.
That when I got in my car, I turned on my radio, they were talking about it. I opened up Google. It was on the homepage of Google. It didn't even say Google anymore. It just said, "This is the best book I've ever read," with a picture of the book on there, Hip Hop and Other Things. And it's crazy the amount of good reviews we've been getting so far. Every place, every person you can think of.
Something I've always wanted to ask you is, how are you so good at promoting your shit? Because like, I think it's underrated. People don't realize, one, how hard it is to talk about the stuff you're doing in a way that people are not like, okay, enough. You do it with an enthusiasm and an energy that is like so sincere and real. And I am incapable of, I can't get to that place a lot of times. How do you do it?
Let's be clear. There are a bunch of people who are like, "Shay, you got to shut the fuck up about this book already." Like a lot of, like I get it every day on Twitter, every single day. But mostly everybody is very nice and supportive, which is great. And I think it's probably because of what you're talking about here. It's just, I'm like genuinely excited about this stuff.
Yeah.
You and I, we have like a similar coming up story where neither one of us expected to be where we are. We both,
not at all.
We both assumed very early on that we would just be doing manual labor jobs for our whole entire life. So every day that we don't have to fucking pick something heavy up, we're just excited and we feel great. And that's what's going on here.
Well, Shay, I asked you to watch the movie Dune, starring one of our favorites, Oscar Isaac, as Duke Leto Atreides, or as I call him, Dilf Leto Atreides. what did you think of Dune? Did you like it? Let's talk about it.
I fucking loved it. Listen, I never read any of the books. I didn't know anything about the story. Probably for 3 months after they started talking about this movie was getting made a couple of years ago, I thought they were talking about the movie Doom. The video game Doom. I was like,
Doom would start.
I was like, I know that. Like, I played that video game. Oh, they're remaking that movie with The Rock? That's a good idea. That's what I thought it was. I had no idea about Desert Power or anything. And then I started, you know, the picture started coming out, the trailer started coming out. It's like, I don't think this is the same thing. This is a different thing.
This is not Doom.
Where's the guns? Where are the big guns? What's going on here? So I watched it and it fucking ruled. It was so, it looked expensive, number one, which is.
It looks expensive.
It looks so good.
It
looks so good.
It looks like a million, zillion, billion bucks on the screen.
Every single frame. The people who made it, you could tell they cared about every grain of sand and like the way that it blew, the little even the little bug or whatever, the spy, the hunter thing that comes, that is like going to stick him in his eyeball when that thing came through the, like every single little piece of it. It was just so much fun. I was super into it, like all the way plugged in. When it gets to the end and fucking Timothée Chalamet gets into the fight with a guy when they're like, we're going to fight to the death. I didn't know anything was coming. And the guy of course challenges the mom and Rebecca Ferguson.
Rebecca Ferguson is the lady Jessica.
I don't know anybody's name from the movie except for Paul.
It's okay.
Except for Paul. He's the only one that I know because they said it 100 times. Like, I get it. So they like Rebecca Ferguson defeats Javier Bardem. And like, she's apparently the leader now. And he's like, I want to challenge her. Oh, who's going to fight for you? Who's your king? And then Paul steps forward. And I was like, let's fucking go. Come on, Timothée Chalamet. Let's go. And then they do that whole fight scene. And he keeps beating the guy and like putting the blade up to his neck. But he won't cut him. And
he won't do it.
I'd never seen that before. And then the guy's like, is he toying with him? And she says,
yeah, is he fucking with him?
He's never killed a man before. And then
that was really felt shit.
That felt like, so cool.
That felt like really, I mean, that's a thing in the books, but on the screen, it was like, oh shit, I got to kill this guy.
Yeah.
Everybody expects me to, and they're all just going to watch.
That's, I think, what makes this movie so much fun to watch is because you have like all of the like giant spectacle of the situation is one thing. But in that moment, that one little moment, you felt the weight of this kid having to kill another human. When she says that line, she gives a great look on her face. He gets knocked down and then he stands up and he's like a little bloodied on his nose or whatever. He stands up and then the fucking chant comes on in the background and you're like, oh, he's going to do it. And then sure enough, oh my God, it's so good. It was so much fun to watch. It was incredible. I want to watch it again.
I've watched it several times. It holds up. I've really enjoyed it. Shay, I would like to now, in honor of Oscar Isaac being in this movie.
Yes.
I would like to revitalize, resuscitate, and rejuvenate and bring back to life a segment we did on our podcast, The Connect.
Yeah, baby.
Specifically a reference to the episode, I Thought This Computer Was My Friend, in which we talked about the movies Upgrade and Ex Machina, starring, of course, Oscar Isaac in a role that is much remembered for the incredible dance that he unleashes in the middle of the movie. And so I'd like to bring back our segment, The Cafeteria Table, in which we would take a person from the movies that we selected to sit at the table, who would then be joined by people from movies that shared the theme that we had. Our theme in this case for our cafeteria table will be hot dads.
Yes.
Oscar Isaac.
Yes.
If he's your dad and Rebecca Ferguson is your mom, you're like, I get it. My parents are hot. Every time your friends would come over, they'd be like, man, your dad is like, what's going on, dude? Like, your parents so hot.
Why does your dad look like that?
Why does your dad look? Listen, if anything ever happens with your dad and Lady Jessica, let me know, because what's going on? So Oscar Isaac is going to sit at both seats of the table. And we have some empty seats here that now need to be filled by people that we're going to select. So it's two Oscar Isaacs and they're chatting along. They're being very charming to each other, sitting at the table. And we've got these empty seats that we are now going to fill, two empty seats each. Shay, would you like to go first? Who is sitting at your table the hot dad table with Oscar Isaac.
Is this, so this is Oscar Isaac from Dune and Oscar Isaac from Ex Machina? They're just hanging.
Perfect.
Okay, they're just talking?
Yeah, they're just hanging.
Okay, because he was the father of the robots. So there you go. Okay. All right, well then in that case, so I have two seats to fill, and there's a bunch of them. Oh man, so many hot dads.
So many hot dads out there.
An underrated one, Jake Gyllenhaal in Southpaw. Not that
great one.
Not that great of a movie, but he's smoking hot in it. Edward James Olmos in Selena.
That's a good one.
Very sexy, like dad energy. I need a can't miss. That's what I need. I'm gonna start with. I'm gonna start with somebody who you don't think of this person as a dad in your head. You forget that he's a dad. You forget. As soon as the scene is over with him and his son, you forget. But Denzel Washington in Training Day. Alonzo. Him and Eva Mendez have a kid together. I think he has like another family somewhere. I assume he does.
Yeah.
They imply it in the movie.
Not a great dad,
not a great, an awful dad. Miserable dad.
Awful dad.
We're going to have a gunfight. We're going to have a shootout, a shotgun shootout with my kid hiding in a hall closet. Like that kind of dad. Not a great dad, mm-hmm. but a hot dad. A dad that could sit down at a table with Oscar Isaac and Dune and Oscar Isaac and Ex Machina and not be completely blown out of the water. That's my pick right here. That's who I'm going with.
That's a great one.
Thank you.
I also needed a can't miss. I was thinking. I considered Antonio Banderas from Spy Kids.
Yeah, good one.
Which is, I think, you know, you can't go wrong there. But I felt it like, let's do something that's a little more recent. So I went with Winston Duke from Us.
Nice pick.
Winston Duke.
Nice pick.
Black Panther and Us. Best thighs in the game. I think he's like 6'6".
That's a big dad.
So it must be great having like a big, strong dad who could just like carry you around. So I'm going to say Winston Duke from the 2019 existential horror film Us. He is a fantastic and protective and scary when he needs to be dad in that movie. Winston Duke, Gabe Wilson from Us.
He was only scary in that movie as the scary version of himself. Like the normal dad version was completely outgunned. Just like, this is not, it's not going to work out great for you, sir. It is not. All right. Here's my next pick. My other seat that I'm going to fill it in. And again, not a great dad in the movie. Kind of a dick.
Right.
Super.
Yeah.
Super not great dad in a movie, but absolutely, unquestionably, this guy, when he goes to the park with his kids or when he picks his kids up from school, all of the moms notice. Everybody notices. They're like, oh shit, he's coming. Oh, he's here. He's here. Did you see him? Brad Pitt in Tree of Life. Give me Tree of Life, Brad Pitt. What a dick of a dad, but just smoking
what a
hot.
Bad dad.
When you're that hot, can be that much of a jerk, I think. That's true.
Remember when the dinosaur showed up in Tree of Life?
Yeah. I don't know what was going on.
Were you like, what the fuck is happening? Why is there a dinosaur in this?
No clue what the movie's about.
I did not get what that was.
This is all I remember. I had at the time taken to teaching my sons how to box. We bought the gloves. Yeah. We bought the mitts. We're doing the drills in the front yard, or like at the time we lived in a little townhouse. So in the front of our townhouse, we're doing it. And I was like being a little more aggressive than I needed to be. I was a young dad. I thought I needed to be like tough dad. No, like this is how you do it. Like being a jerk of a dad. And then we watched Tree of Life and they have the exact same scene that they're in the front yard. And I was like, is that what I look like? Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm so sorry. Like, I'm so sorry. I need to apologize to my sons right now. Never again. But smoking hot dad. That's mine.
Great pick. Again, it would be really distracting when your friends came over and your dad was Brad Pitt. My pick, I considered Krasinski in A Quiet Place. Mm-hmm. Although, again, I would argue not a great dad.
Oh, terrible.
Like, it should not take until your kids are like 11 years old before you tell them, hey, the things can't hear you in the waterfall.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's important information to share earlier on. Special note of respect from me for all the different ways that Krasinski puts his finger to the side of his nose in that
movie. Creative.
He does it like eight different ways to tell people to be quiet. I also considered Paul Rudd from Ant-Man.
I thought about Paul Rudd too. Very handsome. Very handsome.
A very handsome guy. Ageless wonder, Paul Rudd. Super charming, super fun. But I went with John Cho.
Ooh.
From the movie Super Hot Dad.
Searching.
The movie Searching, yeah. in which he is looking for his missing daughter. Listen, if I'm missing, I want my dad to turn over every single rock, to look in, to cross every single river, to go into every single forest to look for me. And it would also be great if he was a great looking guy because I think that would help with the news coverage.
Absolutely.
You know, people would be like,
absolutely,
we got to, hey, that hot dad is on TV.
Yeah.
Talking about where is this kid at? And John Cho, super handsome guy, super hot guy. John Cho in Searching.
That's a great, great pick. I love that movie. Like just, I had.
Good one. I only recently saw it.
It was really, really, really good. I like our picks. I think this is a very good table.
I will say now he is David in Searching, played by John Cho, is also maybe not the best dad, but he's working on it. He's thinking about it. Like he's admitting that maybe I wasn't the best dad in mm-hmm. certain points of view. So I would argue maybe the best actual, no, you know what? Gabe Wilson is also very good. But like one of the better fathers, certainly when compared to Brad Pitt as Mr. O'Brien in Tree of Life and Alonzo from Training Day. That is our cafeteria table. It is Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto from Dune. Oscar Isaac from Ex Machina, the father of the robots. Shay selected Alonzo, played by Denzel Washington in Training Day. Not a great dad, but certainly a hot dad. He selected Mr. O'Brien, Brad Pitt, in Tree of Life, going a little too hard in the paint with the boxing lessons as a dinosaur mysteriously looks on. I selected Winston Duke as Gabe Wilson from Us, a wonderful father when he's not the evil version. And I selected John Cho as David Kim in Searching, looking for his missing daughter. See Searching if you can. It's a great film. Shay, I love our picks.
I love our picks too.
Shay, one more time.
Yes.
Tell the folks about your latest book and why they should buy it.
Hip Hop and Other Things, wherever you buy stores. It has been personally endorsed by Jake Gyllenhaal, Denzel Washington, Edward James Olmos,
right.
Lawrence Fishburne,
right.
Brad Pitt,
that's right.
Oscar
that's
Isaac, right. every dad we've talked that's about right. here, they all posted about it on their Instagram or Twitter. I think they might have deleted it already or it was like a story. You might have missed it, but it was there. I promise.
It was there. They thought, yeah, they had to delete it and take it down because it was almost too much praise.
People were they were saying too much nice stuff.
I've heard it said that it is the greatest book of all time and that the art by the great Arturo Torres is the greatest art that has ever been put to a book of all time.
What a lot of people have said, like scientists, are that if enough people buy the book and open it, it will release neuro whatevers into the air that will reverse the climate change. It'll fix it.
I really hope that people, if only to stop climate change and preserve life on Earth, I hope they buy the book in large numbers, the physical version, the Kindle version. The ebook does not release the gases, the neuro stuff that changes the environment, but the physical book does. Folks, buy it wherever you buy books. Shay, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, later.
That's it for the Endgame, the revamped cafeteria table. Let us know if you have any additions to the table. Hit us at hashtag XRV Endgame. That's XRV Endgame. Big thank you to Shay Serrano, Jason Goldman, and H for joining us today on X-Ray Vision. Please join us each week on Wednesdays for your weekly dose of the deepest dives. Next week, we'll be doing a comics corner where myself and Rosie Knight will be talking about some of the comics that we really like that are going on right now and maybe some recommendations. If you want to learn more about what we explore in each episode, check out our listener's guide to all things X-Ray Vision in the show notes on our website. That just took a very deep hit of spice and foresaw an increase in 5-star ratings. 5-star ratings! Please add them wherever you get your podcast. Goodbye! X-Ray Vision is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Chris Lord and Saul Rubin. The show is executive produced by me, Jason Concepcion, and Sandy Gerard. Caroline Reston and Carlton Gillespie are our consulting producers, and our editing and sound design is by Sarah Gibalaska and the folks at Chapter 4. Big thanks to Brian Vasquez for our theme music.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Leesa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.